This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. For the rest of this hour, we want to talk about globalization. Most books on the subject focus on how the forces of globalization change a culture. The assumption is that as the world gets smaller and more interconnected due to technology, the world becomes more homogenized, slowly wiping out local customs, traditions, and loyalties. In a new book called How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization, New Republic staff writer Frank Foer uses soccer to examine globalization, and what he has found is that tribal loyalties still exist. Frank joins us now here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're not one big happy soccer family? Is that what I'm to assume?
More or less, that's the point that the book tries to make. I spent about 8 months traveling the world. And before I was traveling the world, I was a couch potato soccer fan. And sitting from the perspective of my couch and what I was watching on TV and watching teams that were, you know, you'd have a Basque team that was coached by a Welshman and be filled with Serbs and Dutchmen. And it just seemed to me that the game of soccer was so much further along in the process of globalization than almost anything on the planet. So I spent eight months traveling the world, watching soccer games primarily, searching for the truth about globalization secondarily. And so on my travels, I met fan clubs in Belgrade that had been turned into paramilitary units during the Bosnian War. I went to Glasgow, Scotland, which has two teams, a Protestant and a Catholic team, and each time they play, it's as if the Protestant Reformation was being fought over. And so, so looking at all this stuff, it just seemed to me that the opposite of what everybody predicted about globalization was happening. It wasn't bringing us all together, that there was all this evidence about how tribalism and ethnic conflict was not just sticking around, but seemed to me to be getting more intense.
I wanted you to expand a little bit on those stories that you mentioned, Serbia, for example. And I also want to remind our listeners that they are welcome to join in this discussion about soccer and globalization. The number is 1-800-989-8255. But tell me a little bit more about that.
So there's a club in Belgrade called Red Star. And in 1991, they won the European Cup. They were champions of the entire continent. And at the same time, they were having all this great success on the pitch. In their fan clubs were being mobilized into paramilitary units by the government. And this wasn't that big a stretch for the fan clubs. They'd been some of the most notorious hooligans on the planet. And so the idea was you could just take them, you know, tweak their ideology a little bit, give them guns. They'd be able to do the same sorts of things that they were doing in the soccer stadium, but this time for political ends. And the question, how does this relate to globalization? How does this explain the world? Well, I think one of the things you hear most often when the Balkans conflicts are described is that, well, this is just ancient hatreds playing themselves out. But when I went and I visited with some of these fan clubs and visited with some of the guys who did some of the real dirty work in the wars, what it seemed to me was that, yeah, there was ancient hatreds, but more than that, these guys were gangsters. And it was a peculiar sort of gangsterism because they were modeling themselves off of things that they'd seen in pop culture. They were watching soccer games and they were studying English and Italian hooligans and borrowing things from them. They were listening to African-American gangster rap, which was their favorite form of music, and borrowing things from them. So it seemed like this culture of gangsterism had kind of been globalized, and in the Balkans, it ground its way out to its very grim logical conclusion.
And you found the same thing in Scotland, that as you said, the Protestant Reformation was still being played out in the soccer field.
Right. There are two teams in Scotland. One is called Celtic, and they're the Irish Catholic team, and the other is called Rangers, and they are the Protestant team. And each time they play, all this history and hatred gets invoked. You talk about, they sing songs about being up to their knees in Fenian blood. When Rangers play, the Protestant team, the sound system blares Tina Turner's Simply the Best. And at the culmination of the song, 40,000 Protestants sing some pretty nasty stuff about the Pope. And they invoke William of Orange and the Battle of the Boyne. And it's, you know, we could say that this is harmless stuff, and in a lot of ways it is, but there are people who regularly die as a result of this rivalry. And it has echoes on the other side of the Irish Sea in Northern Ireland, where colors become much more than a proxy. They become things that people spill blood over.
But these ancient enmities would still exist. But you're saying that the playing of a game of soccer helps to sort of get people riled up again. I mean, they would exist outside the soccer playing field.
Right.
So what role is it that soccer actually plays?
Well, I'm arguing that the game is really just reflective of things that happen in society. So I have no doubt that people, if the game didn't exist, people would find other outlets for these enmities.
So, but what does it mean, though, your original premise, which was there are all these people playing on these teams from all these different parts of the world playing together? I mean, did you find any examples of where soccer actually represented globalization in a good kind of a way? Or,
well, I think in all sorts of ways it's a good thing. As a fan of the game, when you watch teams play, you can see that their national styles have been transformed by globalization. So, you know, I don't really like the way that the Italians play the game of soccer. They play in a very cynical, defensive way, or at least that's the historical caricature. But then they had all these Dutchmen and Brazilians come, and things just started to change. They started to transform the Italian culture, so it became much more cosmopolitan, attack-minded. And then there's some actually political examples of globalization doing some good. Iran is one thing that I explore in my book. Every time that the Iranian national soccer team plays a World Cup qualifying match or a World Cup match, all sorts of pent-up feelings come rushing out into the streets, and people say some things about the regime that they don't say in other circumstances. And I think it's very much connected to what the game embodies, that the game is a way for people to consume images from the West, ideas about freedom. I mean, if you look at the way that David Beckham styles his hair, which is constantly changing from week to week, there's a certain idea of freedom that's embedded in that. And so if you're sitting in Iran and you have to, you know, cover parts of your body, you're restricted in all sorts of physical ways, that's actually a pretty liberating thing to see.
We're talking about globalization and soccer. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Of course, you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. And we're going to take a call now from Colin in Athens, Ohio. Hi. Or have I got Medler in Raleigh, North Carolina?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Medler.
Well, my question, I'm also an avid soccer fan, and I enjoy the premise, I suppose, but yet it goes back to the point that the speaker was mentioning earlier. There is this huge globalization that you notice, actually, in the soccer teams, where you have players from, you know, Serbia playing in probably Turkish teams and on and on and on, but yet all of a sudden now we find out that, you know, soccer also is a display of non-globalization. How does that really go with each other?
I think it's a question of how you define globalization. I mean, I'm just by globalization, what I mean is that you have all these mixings of nationalities, of styles, of cultures, of economies, labor, capital moving freely across borders, and globalization at its most elemental level, which is the world becoming a smaller place. But I guess there's a theory of globalization that holds, because the world is getting smaller, because all these changes are happening, we should all get along better. And what I'm saying is, yes, the world's getting smaller, but we're not getting along.
Okay, does that answer your question, Medler?
Well, doesn't that also happen, I mean, even within nations? I'm from Albania originally, and we have this rivalries between them. Doesn't mean that we're not, you know, closer together or as a nation together. It just means that, you know, there's this rivalries, and we fight and we throw rocks at each other, just the way it's done. But at the end of the day, we're still one nation. Doesn't make sense what I'm saying?
It does. And, you know, my thesis isn't universal. It's just there are things that I've observed in various parts of the world that shows how globalization doesn't work the way its proponents claim that it does, and doesn't work the way that its critics say it doesn't. And, you know, there's some instances where, I mean, there are a lot of instances where the game of soccer is just play. And thank God for that.
Franklin Foer is the author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to go to Peter in San Francisco now. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I had a couple of comments for the author. I think some of the things that he's mentioning that he attributes to globalization are actually quite old in the soccer world. There's been players from South America and from different parts of Europe playing in different European clubs and all over South America and all over the globe for quite a long time. Since the 1950s, Real Madrid has fielded, you know, Argentines and Hungarians and really who the best players they could buy. And, you know, Portuguese teams have had African players for quite a long time. So I don't know that a lot of this can necessarily be attributed to globalization as much as it's just, you know, teams go out to make a lot of money and to win, and they've always, you know, gone after the best players.
You're right, of course, about Real Madrid and there are lots of other instances of players crossing boundaries before the 1990s. My point is just that in the 1990s, all this accelerated in very dramatic fashion. And, you know, the same thing is true about globalization as a phenomenon. I would say that globalization has been happening as a phenomenon. The world's been getting smaller in all these sorts of ways for a really long time. It's just that in the 1990s, because of technology, productivity, etc., it became much. There was this burst of globalization, and all sorts of changes that had been happening for a long time accelerated and were more plain to see. If that makes sense.
All right. Thanks for your call, Peter. I mean, I'm kind of wondering too. I mean, isn't a lot of what you're talking about just sort of inherent? Isn't it just part in the nature of sports rather than a reflection of something larger like globalization?
Yeah, I think that there's part of it that's in the nature of sports, in the nature of rivalry, in the nature, you know. So I'm describing the game in a way that makes it sound, in some cases, a lot more freighted and heavy than it actually is. But I do think that that if you look at the cultures of the game and of the way that various games are played around the world, there are differences. I mean, I think that a Michigan-Ohio State rivalry in college football plays itself out a lot more differently than the Celtic Ranger one does in Glasgow, and I think that's significant.
Do you watch soccer in a different way now that you've gone and done this book and traveled all around and seen this for yourself? Do you see it differently now?
Well, I actually think one of the reasons that I was drawn to the game initially was because I was a nerdy kid, and there was always this geopolitical subtext to the game, and that was part of the appealing aspect. And but one of the things that's very appealing about the game is as well is just the organic nature of it. People feel genuine love and passion for their teams because their teams are deeply rooted in their community and their sense of self. And I found it to be a refreshing. I was drawn to the game because it offered such a refreshing contrast from the way that American sports are played. That I feel like when I watch American sports on TV, there's always a scoreboard telling you how to feel. There's always a mascot jumping up and down telling you what to sing. But in watching soccer, it all is just such pure passion and doesn't need to be concocted in that sort of way.
And interesting, too, that Americans don't really share in that sort of international love of the sport.
That's true. As a lover of the game, I'm always tempted to point to evidence of the game's growth here and to become a Pollyanna. And it's true that, you know, my local club, DC United, has 18,000 fans that attend its average game, which I think is a lot. But, you know, point taken.
I think this was just an excuse for you to do a book about soccer, Frank.
Don't tell my wife.
Franklin Foer is a staff reporter for the New Republic and author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary.